Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Dr. John Vile, MTSU's most prolific author, is back with another book. This time it's The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, published by Roman and Littlefield. John is a scholar of constitutional law, former chair of the Department of Political Science, and for the past several years, dean of the University Honors College and leader of MTSU's mock trial team. This is a man who is so into the Founding Fathers that he has Pez dispensers of the first five presidents of the United States in his office. I kid you not. Our Constitution Week look at the writing and ratification of the Constitution begins after a preamble from MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. MTSU now has a one-stop website for the campus community and the rest of the world to learn about upcoming activities at MTSU, www.mtsu.edu/calendar. Easily searchable and with a website that's easy to remember and bookmark, the calendar includes each event that's scheduled in or at an MTSU facility and has contact information as well as more details via a hot link. Dr. Bud Fisher is the new dean of the College of Basic and Applied Sciences. Fisher joined MTSU on August 1st after serving as biology department chair for the University of Alabama at Birmingham. His research is in a wide diversity of biological areas, including aquatic ecology, evolutionary biology, fishery biology, and physiological biology. For MTSU News Anytime, go to mtsunews.com.
Welcome back, John. Hey, the subtitle of your book is Practical Virtue in Action. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's actually a phrase that I borrowed from William Patterson, who was a member of the New Jersey delegation. And it's designed to indicate that, you know, the Constitution was not designed to be a mere theoretical document, but was really an exercise of what Aristotle probably would have called practical wisdom or practical virtue. And I think when judged by that standard, the document comes across pretty good. If you judge it by the standard of did it create absolute democracy or bring about nirvana, obviously it did neither of those. But in terms of being a pretty good, you know, working document for 225 years, done a great job.
That has been the defining factor of American politics, hasn't it, since its inception? I mean, It's not without philosophical foundation, but it's pragmatic. It's all about getting the job done.
It is, and there's been a debate since the founding, but particularly since the Progressive Era, about what the relationship is between the principles and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And I think that for the most part, they're complementary. Many of the people who attended the convention had also signed the Declaration of Independence or fought in the Revolutionary War. And I think it is an attempt to give concrete embodiment to many of the ideals that the Revolution had been fought for.
After it became obvious that the Articles of Confederation weren't working, how and when did the convention take shape?
Well, there are a couple preludes. As you indicate, the Second Continental Congress had written the Articles in 1777. They weren't adopted officially till 1781. There were a couple meetings, a meeting at Mount Vernon, a meeting in Annapolis prior to the convention. But the fascinating part about the convention is it really was called to sort of revise and enlarge the Articles. And instead, largely, I think, because of the Virginia Plan, which seems to be primarily the work of James Madison, although it was introduced by Governor Edmund Randolph, largely because of the Virginia Plan, instead of just starting with the Articles and making revisions, they started with a whole new plan.
Explain the Virginia Plan.
Well, maybe the best way is to sort of contrast it. Under the Articles, there was a single branch of government, Congress. Virginia Plan called for three. Under the Articles, each state had a single vote. Under the Virginia Plan, states were represented in a two-house legislature, both on the basis of population. There were greater powers given to Congress under the Virginia Plan. And the Articles basically had a confederal government where the national government had to, such as it was, and it was fairly weak, had to act through the states. in the Virginia plan and ultimately in the Constitution that the national government has the power to act directly on the individual, and that's what today is referred to as a federal government.
We came to the realization, or I should say our constitutional founding fathers did, that there can't be 13 different kinds of currency and other problems.
They did, and yet, you know, one of the innovations of the Constitution is federalism. I mean, there was a genuine attempt to preserve the existence of states and give them some power over local matters. And, you know, that's one of the unending debates in the United States. And obviously, in one case, it led to civil war. But there's still, you know, still discussion as late as this last term. You know, does the commerce power, for example, give Congress the power to mandate that individuals buy health care? You can't just read the Constitution necessarily and come up with a yes or no answer to that.
But today's debates are more about big government versus small government or federal versus state than it is about large state versus small state, right?
That's correct. Although both, you know, both argue or both that and divisions between the, you know, the North and South over slavery, and there were a lot of other divisions within the Constitution. But the primary difference between the New Jersey plan and which followed the Virginia plan as an alternative was basically that it wanted to keep the equal state representation that states had had under the Articles. So probably the large state, small state, which really means more populous versus least populous, the great compromise, as it's known, or the Connecticut Compromise, seems to be sort of the key compromise of the convention, followed by a lot of others.
How were the delegates to the convention chosen?
They were chosen by the state legislators. Now, the Constitution was eventually ratified by state conventions, but in terms of the delegates themselves, and of course the delegates to the Continental Congresses had been chosen by state legislators, as were U.S. senators prior to the adoption of the 17th Amendment.
One of your main points seems to be that the tone and the tenor of the debate in this convention was quite different than what we in the 21st century have come to loosely call debate.
Well, yes. I mean, modern debate, as you see it on television, is often, you know, three or four people seeing who can scream the loudest. One of the reasons we might hypothesize that the debates didn't happen this way is one, the stakes were a lot larger, but the other is the proceedings were not open to the public. The media today, of course, would probably go nuts if that happened. But many people believe that because the delegates were not in a position where they had to posture to outside audiences, that they did listen more carefully, perhaps, and express greater willingness to compromise than if they thought that was going to affect the next election.
We'll take a break. We'll be right back with more on MTSU on the Record after this.
The Middle Tennessee State University Women's Studies Research Series features compelling monthly talks on gender-related topics by faculty and graduate students. The series offers a chance to learn about research in progress and to chat with faculty in an informal setting. All lectures are free and open to the public and are held on the MTSU campus. This is Associate Professor of Journalism, Dr. Jane Marcellus.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking with John Vile. He's the Dean of the University Honors College and the author of The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution. When we see in fictionalized accounts of the writing of the Declaration of Independence, everybody talks about how hot it was, and they just wanted to get it done and get the heck
yes.
out of there. What sorts of physical conditions were present at the Constitutional Convention?
Well, I mean, any public meeting that you would have gone to in 1787 would have been hot if it was held in the summer. And this wasn't an exception. There have been scholars who have gone back and checked on the weather, and it wasn't a hotter summer than usual. They did, however, keep the windows closed, in part because they didn't want anybody overhearing the proceedings. And, you know, a lot of the people would have had powdered wigs on. Many of them wore wool clothing, even in the summer. So it would not have been the most comfortable place to have been.
Why were they so conscious about keeping people from hearing what they were doing?
Well, I mean, I guess we should make a distinction. Ultimately, the entire Constitution was reported out as written, and it was, you know, voted on in convention, so people had access. But I think the thought was that the deliberations, you know, they didn't want people jumping to hasty conclusions. There were a lot of odd ideas, frankly, that were advanced at the convention that didn't get any farther. And, you know, if somebody had stood up, and I don't know that anybody specifically did, but if somebody said what we need is a king, you don't want that appearing in the paper the next day and having the population think you're bringing George III back.
What were some of the screwier ideas that did not make it into the Constitution?
Well, I'm not sure so much that they were screwy as they were just different. One of the fascinating things is that Madison is often called the father of the Constitution, and he contributed as much as anyone. But he wanted a council of revision, which would have allied the presidency and members of the judiciary together to review acts of legislation, and that was not adopted.
And that would have thrown a corkscrew into separation of powers.
Well, and it somewhat intimates the process of judicial review. But it would have messed with separation of powers, and he also wanted a congressional veto of state laws.
Which issue sparked the most contentious debate of all?
It was definitely the representation in Congress, with, you know, the most populous states thinking that it was only fair that both houses be apportioned according to population, and the lower states, you know, sort of reveling in the equal apportionment that they already had under the Articles of Confederation. But, you know, there were certainly controversies over, you know, what majorities you needed to pass navigation laws, whether and how slaves at all were to be represented, those kind of things.
How deep in the weeds did they feel they needed to get? In other words, did the majority of them feel that the Constitution needed to provide a general framework without a great many details, or did they feel that it needed to be explicit down to the nth degree?
Primarily the former. There are notes that Edmund Randolph left on, I believe it was the Committee of Detail, in which he lists as one of the principles that the committee used to articulate major rather than minor principles. Now, that being said, there are some provisions within the Constitution, for example, allowing the importation of slaves for up to 20 years, that seem overly precise and, you know, reflect basically the need to adopt a compromise on the issue between North and particularly the deep South Carolina and Georgia on that issue.
How many of the people at the Constitutional Convention were also present at the signing and the argumentation over the Declaration?
You know, I should know the precise number. There's some overlap, probably 5 to 10 total delegates. Interestingly, there were 56 delegates who were members of Congress who signed the Declaration of Independence. There were 55 who attended the Constitutional Convention. And of those, 39 of 42 who remained at the end ended up signing the document.
Was it largely an intellectual marketplace mm-hmm. of ideas, or did personalities enter into it at least as much as intellectualism?
I think it was probably a good combination of both. The scholars, of course, like to concentrate on the big issues. But you wonder, you know, one of the things that we have very good notes from the convention. James Madison sort of appointed himself an unofficial scribe, and we know almost every speaker, how many times they spoke and what they said. What we don't know is what happened in the back rooms. Washington, for example, said, you know, was presided over the convention, but said almost nothing in public, and yet Franklin said more in the convention, but didn't say quite as much. But we know he had a lot of people over for lunch and supper, and so, you know, it may very well be that if, you know, that behind the scenes some glad handing was going on and some compromising was going on that is not fully reflected in the record.
If it was Franklin, I suspect lunch and supper and drinks.
Well, possibly so, and he would not have been alone in that respect. many of the framers knew how to have a good time, but, you know, and they were pretty serious people as well.
So, as is the case today, it was politics with the personal touch, which sometimes carried the day.
It did, and you know, sometimes you'll, you know, often you'll see, you know, sort of northern-southern conflict in, you know, some of the character descriptions that we have. One of them, William Pierce of one of the southern states, refers to the very odd accent of Roger Sherman, which I suspect is probably, you know, maybe the like a New England accent that we might hear today. Coatsworth Pinckney at one point says, you know, he came with a lot of suspicion of his fellows, but during the course of the debate, he had concluded that, you know, people from other parts of the country were a little bit better than he thought they were. So,
well, there was one Jay Bird, and I have to ask you about this guy because he's such a character, Gunning Bedford.
Yes, he's a little hothead.
He came right out and said to the lot of them, "I don't trust you."
He did, and he basically said, you know, he was from Delaware, and he was arguing on behalf of the small states. He was an attorney. So he was used to making fairly vigorous arguments, and he basically said, "Well, you know, if you guys want to move to representation on the basis of population, I'm sure we can find a foreign ally." Now, he gets a lot of blame for this, but frankly, he was probably saying what a lot of people were thinking. And Governor Morris, pretty much a week later, said something very similar, and very few people got on his case.
But Bedford said it in such a smart-ass way that he probably alienated a few people.
Well, he probably did. On the other hand, you know, he apologized and did so largely on the basis that as an attorney, he was used to vigorous representation for his clients.
Well, he reminds me of James Traficant, at least.
Well, at least he was actually a bit better educated than him, but in any event.
One can only hope. We'll take another quick break, and we'll be back. This is MTSU on the Record.
Women in Science and Engineering, or WISE, helps college women prepare for and become involved in science-related careers. WISE nurtures women's interest in these fascinating and critical fields and provides mentoring and networking opportunities. The group's main goal is to assure women of their importance in all scientific and technical fields and to promote equal opportunity and treatment of women in science. I'm Dr. Judith Iriarte-Gross, WISE Advisor.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about the writing and ratification of the U.S. Constitution, a new book by Dr. John R. Vile, who is Dean of the University Honors College. The Constitution has been covered in so much of academia. What made you think that you had something to say about it that hadn't already been said?
I'm not sure that I have said something that hasn't been said. And in fact, even by myself, I did several years back, I did a two-volume encyclopedia, Constitutional Convention of 1787. And as I got to thinking about it, it's like, you know, I have all these A to Z entries. I got an entry on everything and everybody that I could find out about. And I've never done my own narrative. And there's some excellent narratives of the Constitutional Convention. I'd say at least half a dozen. And I'm not sure mine is any better. I think it's as concise as any of them. And I think it's a, you know, something that a typical layperson could probably pick up and read. Usually when I give my mother a book, it's like, why don't you think about writing something that didn't quite so? And she'll sort of look up guiltily and say, boring. and I think this is one that she probably could read and enjoy.
It is. It's only about 181 pages, not counting the selected documents,
right,
and the footnotes that you put in the back and the index, the bibliography, to show that it is thoroughly steeped in academic research.
And as you know, I actually sort of liken it to a case brief. You know, my primary teaching has been on constitutional law, and often you'll have a one-page summary or two-page summary of a case that may go on for 100 pages or more. And I essentially decided, you know, maybe I could take that skill, which I've used in writing some other books, and sort of distill some of the volumes of notes that we have on the convention in a way that somebody could read in a, you know, fairly easy fashion.
You've been so fascinated with the Founding Fathers for so long, I just wonder if you consider yourself sort of an intellectual soulmate of the gentleman.
Well, I would hope so. And one of the things I'm actually now working on a book on biographies of each of the 55 people who were there. And one of the interesting things is, no one will probably ever dislodge Jimmy Madison from first place. But I've had increasing respect for Roger Sherman. There's a gentleman by the name of Hugh Williamson, who is actually Williamson County is named after, and he's one of the most fascinating people at the convention, second only, I would say, to Benjamin Franklin in the breadth of his knowledge. He had degrees, scientific degrees from European universities. He traced comets. He had all kinds of speculation that he wrote about, and these were just very fascinating men.
You said earlier that Washington presided over the Constitutional Convention, but he didn't say much. Wouldn't you think that he would have been reserved in expressing his opinion precisely because he was in that particular position?
That's part of it, but, you know, he also sat through the first 2 or 3 weeks. The convention convened in what's known as a Committee of the Whole with Nathaniel Gorham, if I remember correctly, presiding, and Washington said almost nothing during that time either. Part of it was, you know, he was the kind of person, and I think one of the aphorisms that's sometimes attributed to him is something to the effect that, you know, it's better not to speak and have people wonder whether you're foolish or not than to speak and let everybody know that you are.
Isn't Washington considered by the Academy to be something of an intellectual lesser light by comparison to people like Jefferson?
You know, he is, but I'm not sure it's altogether fair. If you look at what actually happened at the convention, Washington came as close to getting his way probably as almost any other delegate there. He certainly did not, you know, have the depth of learning that a Washington or a Madison did, but he was, you know, if we go back to the title of the book, he was probably as good an exemplar of practical virtue as anyone who was there.
Do you think his ability as a military strategist played into that?
That was part of it. I mean, I think the key to Washington is, you know, George III is reputed to have said at the end of the Revolutionary War, it was reported that Washington was going to turn over his sword back to Congress and return to domestic life. George III is reputed to have said if he does so, he'll be the greatest person in history. And, you know, it was a confidence that people had that here was someone who probably could have seized power if he wanted to and did not, that just gave them great confidence in what happened. The same partly is true of Franklin and the arguments between the Federalist supporters and the Anti-Federalist opponents of the Constitution. Federalists made a big point about how both Washington and Franklin were there, and both of them had signed the document.
Did that personal choice come out of their own individual philosophies, or were they following the example of Cincinnatus?
Well, Washington, of course, was often likened to Cincinnatus, who was the Roman general who, you know, became a temporary dictator, is what they called him, basically Lee general, and then came back. I'm not sure that was exactly what Franklin's model was, but you know, he had this model, I think, of sort of enlightened statesmanship. And Franklin, of course, was the oldest at the convention. He was coming to the end of his life. He was very concerned, as Washington was, about his future reputation.
Did the delegates to the Constitution set a deadline for themselves, or did they just figure it would go on as long as it had to?
But I think they probably wished they had. What's fascinating is if you look at the first 2 weeks, it looks like it's going to be a cakewalk. Everybody's saying yes, you know, great Virginia plan, and then you have just months of controversy. You know, it starts at the end of May. They don't sign the document till September 17th, and, you know, as I may or may not have said earlier, that this year will be the 225th birthday of the signing.
We'll take one more pause, and we'll return with more on MTSU on the Record.
Specialized training in forensic science prepares tomorrow's professionals through the Forensic Institute for Research and Education, or FIRE. The Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team assists law enforcement with skeletal remains at crime scenes. Legendary forensic scientists provide lectures free to the public, and high school students work realistic crime scenes each summer at our CSI MTSU camp. I'm Dr. Hugh Berryman, Director of FIRE.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
In our final moments with Dr. John Arvile, I wanted to bring this up because I had written a newspaper column about it. There was a study by researchers at Washington University in St. Louis and the University of Virginia. You're familiar with it already, I can tell.
Well, I'm familiar with the University of Virginia, for sure.
Okay.
Mr. Jefferson's University, as we would say.
Of course. The two of them together analyzed 729 constitutions adopted by 188 countries between 1946 and 2006, went over them clause by clause, and they found that fewer countries are using America's Constitution as the one they want to emulate, compared to almost all, every country in the world in a survey done by Time in the Time magazine in the 60s. They say it's because the Constitution is too inflexible and has not included rights that they say keep up with the times, like women's rights, the right to health care, the right to food. What's your take on that?
Well, actually, you know, Justice Ginsburg had a statement or had an interview some time back saying she wouldn't necessarily advise people to use the U.S. Constitution. I think there's two things wrong with the study. One is many of the principles, you know, separation of powers, judicial review, some of the institutions are very much alive in other constitutions. The other is, you know, there are a lot of constitutions. The typical 20th century constitution has a sort of a laundry list of rights, everything from, you know, minimum wage to paid vacation. And I think many of those have subsequently found that just because you put them in a constitution doesn't necessarily mean they're enforceable. The U.S. Constitution, unlike earlier Bill of Rights or Bills of Rights, wasn't simply a set of aspirations. It was a set of enforceable rights that people had. You know, there is an amending clause, I guess would be the other response that I have. Women certainly have gotten the right to vote. African Americans have been freed. And many things have been done outside the Constitution that, in fact, have, I think, I certainly think our Constitution is as up-to-date as any in the world.
Is the Constitution too hard to amend?
There are certainly a lot of people who think so. I do not. That's one of my areas of expertise, as you know. I've done a lot on the constitutional amendments. I think there you can point to a lot of areas where 60% of the people want something right now. That doesn't necessarily mean that 50% would want them 2 weeks from now or 2 years from now. I think it's good to have some restraints on the immediate popular will and stick to the basics.
Was there a great deal of debate about what the amendment process should be at the time of the Constitutional Convention?
There wasn't a lot. What a lot of people forget is that the most inflexible constitution probably you could find was under the Articles. It required the consent of all 13 states. No one knew for sure, you know, what two-thirds majorities of both houses of Congress and three-quarters of the states would look like. If they had it to do over, they might have, you know, they might have tweaked those percentages down a bit. But the attempt was to have something that was changeable, unlike the Articles of Confederation, and yet not so flexible that, you know, it would become a form of periodic literature.
The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, Practical Virtue in Action by Dr. John R. Vial. It is published by Roman and Littlefield Publishers. Go to www.roman.com.
Or Amazon.com.
That too. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, MTSUnews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at MTSUnews.com and on iTunes.